Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome back to a new episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jingyi Li from the University of Arizona. Today, we welcome Professor William Ferris and his new book, A Bowl for a Coin, The Commodity History of Japanese Tea. It was published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2019. Professor Ferris is a professor emeritus of Japanese history at the University of Hawaii, where he taught and researched about early modern Japanese history. This book is a deep dive into the history of all teas in Japan, from its introduction in the 8th century to medieval period cultivation and to its modern day transformation. Through the consumption and commodification of tea, Professor Ferris also pictures the transformations of the Japanese society of centuries. So welcome, Professor Ferris. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And my apologies that we missed your book pitch from a year ago. You have been studying and writing about Japanese history for such a long time. What have you recently been interested in?
Well, actually, I made a rather important discovery. During the pandemic of COVID-19, I had a friend on the Pre-Modern Japanese Studies Network ask me about whether there had ever been plague in Japan. And at first I said, no, I don't think so. I've written many books. I've written a lot on epidemics in Japanese history. And I said, no, I don't think so. But then I began to look at the evidence again. And I found what I think is probably the plague that came into Japan, both in the late 9th and early 10th century, and then most importantly, brought in by the Mongols in the 13th and 14th century. So if that's true, that will be a really big discovery. It's not exactly 100% certain yet, but I'm hoping to publish a paper on that very soon.
Wow, exciting. I look forward to reading it then. Why did you choose to write about tea? It's quite different from some of the topics you've written about over the years. So why tea?
Well, there were actually two reasons. First of all, when I went to the University of Hawaii, I was the Sen Distinguished Chair in Traditional Japanese History and Culture. And one of my duties there was to work with Urasenke, which is a Japanese tea lineage, tea group, and work with Dr. Sen Genshitsu, the former head of Urasenke. And I taught a course on tea. I wasn't interested in tea at all, and I'm not really terribly interested in the tea ceremony. But as a result of writing that course, I thought about, you know, there's so much that's written on the Japanese tea ceremony on Chanoyu, but there's really nothing written on tea as it was consumed daily or as a kind of economic commodity. And so I thought, can I do this? And I got a grant from Fulbright to go to Japan in 2010, 2011, began researching. It was very hard at first because everything you came to was Chanoyu, was with the tea ceremony. And then I found a scholar in the Kyoto Nara region who wrote some things on tea and on the farming and processing and trading of tea. And that led me into other things. And then I found more and more, and gradually it became a book.
That's awesome. So before we talk about the history of tea in Japan, what are some of the key factors about tea that would help us understand your points made in the book, since it's such, you know, it's such an everyday object right now, and we rarely think about what is it about tea that makes it such a everyone's favorite beverage. So what about some of the, I guess, the scientific aspects, the factors about tea that we should know?
Okay. First of all, almost all teas come from the same plant, and that plant is Camellia sinensis. And that's true of green tea. That's true of most white teas. And it's also true of black tea that you drink. So no matter what tea you're drinking, you're probably drinking the tea from the same plant. The difference in green tea is that you may often be getting actually the ground up leaf, particularly if you drink powdered tea, you'll be getting the ground up leaf. And in black tea, you only get the liquids that come off the tea when it's put into hot water. So that's one difference. I would say that there are things to know about tea. Not every place in the world can grow tea. You need to have a fairly warm climate, like Japan. If we look at the history of tea growing in Japan, most of the areas where it can be grown are warm. There's actually a line you can draw in Japan. It doesn't grow very well in the north of Japan, so it needs to be warm. You need to have lots of rain, and Japan has lots of rain, so that's good. And the other thing you need to have is loose, sandy soil, so that when the rain comes in, the water will dissipate, go down to the roots, and then go away. Tea doesn't grow well in swampy areas. So that's part of the growing of tea. But then you also have the processing of tea, and there are probably as many ways to process tea. And by processing tea, I mean once you pluck the leaves, sometimes you steam it, sometimes you stir roast it. You always do different things. There are lots of different ways to process tea, and because of that, we have many varieties of tea. So, of course, tea has been traded, and it's also a gift in Japan. It's very popular as a gift for people, and then it's also popular for a while. It was a tax item, so if you think about farming, processing, and trade, It's very interesting. And then tea has also left a very important imprint on the culture of Japan and on China and on, to some extent, on Korea and also on Vietnam, all areas that are important for exporting tea in the world. And those imprints run from poetry to art to advertisements to TV commercials, all sorts of things.
So how was, and when was tea first introduced to Japan? And when it was first introduced, who consumed it and how did they enjoy it? How was it talked about? Are there any textual or visual materials that portrayed tea being introduced or consumed in its earliest stage in Japan?
Tea was probably introduced in Japan. We don't know for sure because we don't have the records that there is a sort of a mythological story about the introduction of tea that links it to a famous emperor in Japan in the early 800s. But scientific evidence and genealogical evidence, they've looked at plants in China, Korea, and Japan, and they found a link, and they think that the tea was introduced in Japan probably sometime in the early 700s, maybe even as late as 750. At the same time, it was introduced into Korea. So although tea is not as important in Korea as it is in Japan or China, it was also introduced into Korea. And it was brought into Japan undoubtedly by Buddhist monks, because those are the people who drank tea in China, in Korea, and in Japan. And if you look at the history of tea in Japan, the tea serves as a kind of network former. It forms a network among all of the Buddhist monks, whether they're Chinese, Korean, or Japanese, and they give it back and forth as gifts, and they drink together, and they really enjoy their tea. So that's how tea was introduced. It was first, so it was probably at first farmed not very widely in Japan and not very well, and probably some bushes were planted that then went wild. But the most important thing was the processing of tea, and tea was processed on a kind of grinder. It's called a druggist mortar, and the druggist mortar looks like a wheel that grinds into a trough. And because it was processed that way, the tea came out very clumpy. It was like a big clump. And when you put it in water, it didn't turn green, it turned brown, and it was very bitter. So the early people who drank, the monks, and then eventually aristocrats, Heian aristocrats who also drank tea, they all drank it as this kind of very bitter substance. And for that reason, it was mostly known as a medicine.
That's quite interesting to know that tea wasn't that enjoyable at a time when people thought it was very fancy. So how did tea transform from being a kind of medicine to beverage?
Well, it's a long story. And even today, if you notice, when people think about green tea, they think about its medicinal effects. They say, well, isn't green tea good for preventing cancer? Or can it prevent you from having diabetes or other things? None of these things are particularly true for green tea over any other kind of tea. But it still carries with us this idea that one aspect of tea is that it's a medicine. But it was converted from a medicine to a drinking beverage for something for parties, for something that people really enjoyed, probably beginning in the 1100s, late 1100s, and really the initial work was done by the Chinese. And the Chinese invented the chaozu, which in other words, the tea grinder, which is very different from this druggist mortar, and which really grinds the tea into a very fine powder. And it's green, it's not brown. And along with that, the Chinese invented the whisk. And the whisk, these things were all invented in China probably right around 1100. And they made their way to Japan sometime in the 1100s. And so this new tea, powder tea, as you know, although it's sort of an acquired taste, still many people enjoyed tea much more. And then it became an object for parties. And by 1250 or even 1300, you see lots of people having tea, powdered tea particularly, and also steeped leaf tea, not very well done, but a kind of steeped leaf tea that was very crude. But this is all part of parties, and people would have noodles, and they would have dumplings, and they would have other things. It was very much a kind of scenario where tea was linked to China. And since China had such tremendous cultural cachet in Japan, for the elite who drank this, and they were the only ones drinking at this time, monks, civil aristocrats from Heian, and then eventually in the 1200s, warriors started to acquire the taste for tea, and they liked it very much. And then it really became sort of a party thing, that you could drink the tea at parties. And then it became something that people enjoyed for the taste. And so that, I think the technological changes were very important in making tea move from this bitter brown substance where you put persimmon peels and other kinds of things in it to dilute the taste, to something that was green, tasted much better, and could go with other food, and then you could have it at parties. It also takes on very much a social aspect, that when you have guests, you serve them tea, just like they do in Japan today. So all of this was, the conversion really began in the late 1100s in Japan, and then continued in the 1200s, and then continued, and eventually it begins to seep not only to be with the elite, but also become something that commoners begin to pick up.
Fascinating. And is this where this phrase of ball foot coin came from? Does that describe its accessibility around this time?
Yes. Well, in all cases, of course, tea is not just happening in a vacuum, but it's something that happens along with the rest of Japanese society. And beginning in particularly in the 1400s, Japan really developed a commercial economy. And you have artisans and merchants of all kinds selling all sorts of goods in Japan. As the population grew and as probably per capita income went up a little bit in the 1400s. And so in Kyoto and in Nara, and maybe even in some rural towns in Japan, you had these merchants who carried tea, all the tea on their back, and then they carried the implements for tea as well. They set up tea shops, and they would walk through the streets of Kyoto, and they would cry, a bowl for a coin. And they would cry, and then common people began to drink tea. And so this, in Japanese, is ippuku issen. But in any case, though, so this phrase became very common, and it served as a nice title for the book.
Nice. So you mentioned earlier that nowadays, if we were to look, well, before your book, of course, when we look at the history of tea, it's often associated with chanoyu, a tea ceremony. And tea ceremonies or tea parties are also associated often with Zen Buddhism, especially in Japan's medieval period. So what was the connection like? How was they associated?
Well, I'm not a person. I think that the general trend in Japanese studies now is to minimize the amount of connection between Zen and tea, and particularly chanoyu. But there is a connection. There's no doubt about it. So you're right to point to it. And if you look in Zen rituals, tea was consumed regularly in Zen monasteries. And beginning in the 1300s, the Ashikaga shogunate, the third military government of Japan, was very closely linked to Zen monasteries and Zen temples. And in all these areas, as part of the ritual of being a Zen monk, you drank tea. And you drank it with meals. You drank it in various rituals. So it was very much a part of the Zen existence to drink tea. And so it's very important with Zen ritual. But then it's also very interesting because we have collections of poetry. Zen monks were the leading intellectuals of their time, and they wrote poetry. They wrote their poetry in Chinese. So once again, you have these Zen monks, many of whom were traveling to China and to Korea and really viewed Chinese culture as the center of the world in some respects. In many respects. And so therefore, they wrote their poetry in Chinese. And when you read the poetry often makes reference to karma and to Buddhist senses, the Buddhist sense of evanescence, that things are here today, but they're gone tomorrow. And so you have this link culturally with Zen, and then you have the link in the rituals in the Zen monasteries and temples as well. So it is an important link, but I just don't want to overdo it. The early temples where monks drank tea were all much earlier sects, and they liked tea as well.
Right. So that's one thing that I've been curious about for quite a while, is that when we talk about the connection between green tea and tea ceremony and Zen Buddhism, what happened to the other sects of Buddhism? There were a lot of other sects of temples. So in the text that you looked through, were there any indication that they were also drinking tea or hosting tea ceremony in other sects of Buddhism?
The I think you have to distinguish between drinking tea and the tea ceremony. The tea ceremony doesn't really get its beginning until probably the second half of the 1400s, or maybe even certainly the 1500s, with the famous Sin Dikyu that you probably know, and he was a figure of the 16th century. So the tea ceremony, as it's practiced today, really got its beginning in the 1500s, in late 1400s and 1500s. But before that time, Buddhist temples of several sects, and I don't know if you want me to name the sects or not, but there were like Kegon, Ritsu, Shingon, all of those were very famous for the consumption of tea. And there's a temple called Shomyoji, which sits today in Yokohama. And it's related to the Kanazawa Hojo, who were a family of warriors that served very high positions in the Kamakura Bakufu, Kamakura military government. And that temple was not a Zen temple, but it was a Ritsu temple. And the Kanazawa got a lot of their tea from Shomyoji. Shomyoji also had fields where they grew tea. They had estates where the peasants were supposed to farm tea. So for all of these reasons, then, tea was something that was associated with just Buddhism in general and as a way of networking with monks. And you network with Chinese monks and you network with Korean monks and they all work together. So I have this vision of a world unlike what we're usually taught, of kind of horizontal relationships among monks of all kinds in these different areas. And I think that the cultural differences between China, Korea, and Japan, among the elite anyway, meant much less, and rather the tea joined them all together.
Now that you mention the cultivation of tea at this time, how large of the scale are we talking about?
How large is the usual tea patch?
How large the tea fields were? How much did these regions invest into producing tea, growing tea?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we really get our first information on the size of tea fields beginning in the 1300s and 1400s and 1500s. Tea fields are incredibly small. I mean, they might be 1/10 of an acre. And one thing that definitely points to the development of tea in Japan is that temples, other organizations, other people, and peasants as well, learn to cultivate tea. You know, you have a paddy, a rice paddy, and then you have the rows around the rice paddy. So, and they're raised, the furrows around the rice paddy, and Japanese farmers learned to cultivate tea on those furrows. So you had very small fields. You had sometimes it would be like a house garden of tea, just tea for the family. And then there would be tea on the raised portions of the rice paddy. And so you're talking about something where tea was widely cultivated, but it was not cultivated in acres and acres, but it's cultivated rather in 1/10 of an acre or even areas less than that.
Now, entering the Tokugawa period, so entering the 17th century, there was a significant growth of population as well as advancement in agriculture scales and techniques. So how did the production and consumption of tea transform during this time?
Tokugawa period is really, in many ways, sort of the heyday of green tea in Japan. It's the best time for tea, particularly during the 1700s. Cultivation spread in Japan. I mentioned that tea is limited by temperature. And if you think of Japan, if you draw a line between just north of Tokyo and across Honshu to over to Niigata, that is the kind of the natural limit of tea. But in the Tokugawa period, those Japanese peasants were really pretty smart. And what they learned to do was cultivate tea everywhere in Japan, almost to the very northern tip of Honshu. And they did this through various means. They would cover the roots in winter so that they didn't get too cold, even though it was too cold. So one of the characteristics of farming is that you have farming spreading to areas beyond the natural climate limitations of tea. You also have the production of manuals, farm manuals, that tell us a lot about the production of tea in terms of farming. And they talk about, they're incredibly detailed. I don't think I can really remember everything about them. But anyway, though, they're incredibly detailed instructions to people about how to farm tea. And they talk about using fertilizer. And by the Tokugawa period, you did use fertilizer in growing tea. And so there are lots of improvements in farming. And then another part of it was improvements in processing. And one of the things that encouraged the production of tea, particularly for the elite, was the development of what we know today as sencha by a man named Nagatani around 1740. He developed this in Uji, which is, of course, very famous in tea lore in Japan. And he developed a method where the tea leaves, after they had been plucked and steamed, would then be roasted on top of a heated drum. And people would use their hands to kind of mold the tea and to roll the tea and do all kinds of things. And when this tea was then roasted and the sticks were taken out and everything was done well, it gave rise to the most delicious of all teas in Japan, even more delicious than powdered tea. This tea soon became more popular even than powdered tea. And it became a big commercial success too. And it was cultivated very widely in Japan. But one thing you should also remember is that most of the people who drank tea in Japan in the Tokugawa period were farmers. And many of them did not have the sophisticated knowledge to do sencha, but instead they did bancha. They did very relatively low grades of tea. And by far, the majority of people who drank tea in Japan in the Tokugawa period drank this lower level kind of tea, bancha, which was much simpler, but was still very delicious. So all of those things were important. Probably the most important thing of all, though, was the development of commercial networks. And certain regions begin to specialize in tea, like Shizuoka and Uji and parts of Omi province and Ise and other places, all specialize in tea. And then there begin to get the trading of tea. So by the time you get to the end of the Tokugawa period, you have Japan is just awash in tea varieties. There are all kinds of tea varieties. And today, if you go to a place in Kyoto, I believe it's on Shijo Avenue, I'm not sure. But anyway, I think it's called Fukujuin. Anyway, though, you can go there today and you can order whatever brand of tea you want. And you can get it from any place in Japan. So it was very important that people during the Tokugawa period learned or developed the knowledge to make all kinds of different teas. So there were changes in farming, there were changes in processing, and then there were commercial changes. Tokugawa is really the big period for tea.
So if a ordinary person in the Tokugawa period wanted to, well, just drink tea during a day, where would they be able to get them? Do they usually make them at home, or are there places in the streets that they can go to just casually buy a cup of tea?
Both. As I said, most of the population that was drinking tea were peasants. And as I sort of indicated earlier, peasants who farmed all kinds of fields, around the edges of the field would grow tea bushes. And then they would pluck the tea. And generally, this was for home consumption. So probably the majority of the population got their tea by growing the plant. And then during the tea ripens in April. The tea is ready to be plucked in April, so that's just before the busy period in planting rice. so that the timing works out really well. And then once you've done that, then you can process the tea in whatever way you're going to do it. You can roll it, you can steam it, you can roast it, you can do whatever you want to. And then you have tea for home for the whole period. So it becomes something that's done by farmers. But then certainly there were one of the important developments of the Tokugawa period is the development of big cities like Edo and Osaka and Nara and Kyoto and other cities. And in all these cities, you found merchants and you could find even restaurants where tea was available. There's this particular kind of store that was called a chaya. And the chaya was where you could get tea. Unfortunately, in order to attract customers, they made the people who served tea at these chaya, at these tea stores, mostly women. And so the chaya or the tea store became associated with other things, shall we say, than tea, if you get my meaning, with a kind of the feminine virtues and things like that as well. And the Dutch, who were ensconced in Nagasaki at the time, made a big deal about how all of these chaya, all of these tea stores, were places of the most terrible morals. And people would do all sorts of things. But you could go to a chaya, you might get it from a merchant on the street, or particularly if you're a farmer, you might grow it yourself.
Now, as we enter the modern period, so to speak, in 1906, this guy Okakura Tenshin, a frequent name on this channel recently, he wrote the famous Book of Tea that promoted drinking green tea to the West. And as a new member of the modern nation, so to speak, how did Japan industrialize the production of tea and advertise it for the various merits of drinking tea?
Well, tea advertising goes back to the Edo period. If you look, there are, if any of the listeners are familiar with sumo, you know that there are charts that rank the sumo wrestlers. Well, there were advertisements by the 19th century in Japan that ranked restaurants and foods, and they ranked tea. And, of course, the best tea was from Uji. So it was the Yokozuna of tea. And so they're advertising from the Edo period. But in the modern period, then, one of the things that's very important to realize about tea is that, so Japan is forced open by the United States and by the European nations. And the new Meiji government wants to industrialize very quickly. And they say to themselves, what do we have to send to other countries so that we can make foreign currency? And there were three things that the Japanese had that people in Europe and the United States particularly wanted. One of them was silk. Then Japan had coal, which didn't need any particular addition to finish it. But the other was tea. And tea becomes a very important export. And this had both good aspects and bad aspects as well. The bad aspect was that the tea that Westerners liked particularly was sencha. And so Japanese companies standardized sencha, and a lot of those wonderful varieties of the Edo period disappeared as a result of that. So sencha, it's all the same. It's sent to the United States, it's sent to Europe, it's sent to Russia, it's sent all over the world. And it becomes famous Japanese tea, eventually outcompetes Chinese tea, and becomes the favorite in the world. So one thing you must realize is that Japan was a very important tea was a very important export for Japan and made a lot of money for the Japanese. And so that was one thing that was very important. I forgot, what's the upshot of your question then? Oh, you want to know, so when it becomes important for export, then the producers of tea have to find a way to cut their costs. And originally, there were in the late 1800s, early 1900s, probably up until about the 1920s, when April came around and it was time to pluck the tea or when it was time to roll a tea or do whatever you're going to do and get it ready for export, there were these women who came out of the hills, out of all over the place, to make money to do this for the farmers. And so the role of women in the production of tea is something that's very important. And this was one of the ways that tea was processed then in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But eventually, the owners came to realize that they were spending too much on labor. And so one of the important trends is mechanization. And now, if you go to Japan and you go to a place where tea is sold, the whole process is mechanized. They even have computers today that do the whole thing. And there will be something that steams the tea automatically. There will be something that then it gets on a conveyor belt and it goes down and it gets roasted. And it goes are there automatic, these big claws that roll the tea. So there's no human intervention. And they try to save costs as much as possible. So mechanization, another thing that was important was to find the right kinds of tea. And so the Japanese scoured the world for tea. They even tried to make black tea, but the Japanese variety of tea that they had didn't taste very good as black tea. So that failed. And mechanization. And then as you get tea exported, eventually this, and as the export market was particularly good in the United States. Interestingly enough, where I am right now in Illinois, in the Midwest, there are barns. If you're careful and if you go to the right place, there are barns that still have the Japanese advertisements on them for tea that date back to the 1920s and 30s. These advertisements. So eventually, the export though begins to shut down, particularly as you get closer to World War II. And then the idea was, we've got to sell tea to the Japanese. And so then they began to really go in for advertisements of tea to the Japanese. And they made advertisements promoting the health benefits of tea. There was a discovery made, I believe it was in the 1920s, that said that tea contained vitamin C. This is very good for your health. So drink Japanese green tea. So you get a full-on advertisement for tea up until the 1930s when Japan enters the war period. And then they link tea to the war effort and to the effort to fight. And, you know, tea gives you Yamato Damashi, gives you the Japanese spirit if you drink tea. The Japanese lost the war. They were very devastated by the war. But tea came back and came back very strongly in the 1950s and 60s. And there you have lots of advertisements. And today you have modern advertisements of tea that talk about how tea is so good for being sociable and how it's so good. Particularly in very modern advertisements, you have the idea, well, tea is a way to get away from work. Go have a cup of tea and go into some place in nature and relax. Don't work so hard, but relax from tea. Relax with tea. So there were lots of advertisements. And in the book that I wrote, there are several, I mentioned several prize-winning tea advertisements that came out in the 70s and 80s and even later.
So these conceptions about the health benefits of tea that a lot of people would have nowadays, such as, like you mentioned earlier, tea, drinking tea, being able to prevent cancer, or things I've heard like drinking tea or tea containing caffeine, or I guess specifically green tea containing caffeine, therefore can help you work more efficiently. Or even things like drinking green tea can help with your meditation, that kind of thing. So would you say that these were a result of the advertisement campaign for promoting green tea?
Well, I don't think many of the advertisements talk about meditation. But they did talk quite a bit. I mean, it was... whether even if you're drinking the brown tea way back in the 800s and 900s, tea has caffeine in it. And it has catechins in it, and all of these things are good for your health. So there's no doubt that tea is good for you, but that's any tea. Because remember, the tea all comes from the same plant. So even if you're drinking brown tea, if you drink it daily, it's good for you. And it does help your body, it helps you to focus your mind. So it could be good for work. You know, have a glass of tea, focus your mind, get too busy on your work. It could be good also as a kind of meditation, but it's in general, it's good for your health, but I wouldn't want to say that green tea is especially much better than black tea. They're really all about the same. And the other thing is that what people don't realize is that coffee also has the same kind of effect. So coffee and tea both are good for you in health terms.
Well, since we're not a health program, let's move on to talking about, I think, is one of your major points through talking about the history of tea. So for many Western countries, especially nowadays, green tea is closely associated with the Orient, whether it be Japan or China. So from a perspective of consumption and production, what does this history of tea in Japan reveal about the role of green tea in particular as a cultural symbol?
I think it's a cultural symbol of Japan. And I'm pretty sure that, I mean, it's considered in Japan to be a kind of no geibutsu. So, you know, and that's Japanese, but what it really means is that the production and marketing of tea is a kind of art. So that in that sense, this is in Japan, you find it's very true. The Japanese are not nearly the world's largest exporter of tea anymore. China is. But many people think that the Japanese tea is better, tastes better. They want that more. I don't know why. Anyway, though, and it's often hard to distinguish between Chinese and Japanese tea. But it's a cultural symbol in Japan and is a kind of symbol of Japan, just as sushi is or as other things are. It's a symbol of Japan. It's a symbol. It has association with Zen, as we said. So it's associated with meditation and looking inward. And it was particularly associated with Japan in the United States in the 20s and 30s. But even today, you find that the area tea production in Japan is actually going down. And that's because the home market for tea seems to be shrinking. More and more Japanese turn to coffee. This trend began in the after World War II, that they began to turn to coffee rather than tea. But you still find tea counterattacking by selling bottles in vending machines and also at convenience stores and other places. So you find tea all over Japan. And the youth, the concern is that the youth of Japan are going to drink green tea, but they're not even going to know how to make the tea in the teapot. So the point of all this was, though, that tea, the growing area of tea for the Japanese anyway, is the export market. And that's because tea is not only has the health benefits, but it's also associated with Japanese culture. And as Japanese culture has become something of kind of that is in favor around the world, tea is too. And so I'm not sure if I'm getting right at your point about how it symbolizes Japan. I'm not sure if I can do that. But in any case, though, it is certainly something that is associated very heavily with Japan and to some extent China as well and Vietnam. Those are the three major producers of green tea.
Amazing. And through the transformation of the production, the cultivation, the enjoyment of green tea, I guess my last question for you is, how do you see the representation of the transformation of Japanese society through this history of green tea?
Well, I don't know if you want me, maybe I'll just stick to the modern period, but one interesting trend is that green tea became really very central to Japanese culture in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so you find that if you went to an office, that there was always someone who would serve you some green tea. And you find it all over the place in Japan during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it's associated, if you look at literature, which is another place to examine to see the history of tea, you see that tea is always associated with someone being sociable, someone trying to serve a guest, someone trying to be sociable to another person, something like that. And so tea was always something that was known for sociability up to that time. If you look at modern iterations of tea, however, now there are manga characters that are known for their tea. One of them is called Hyogemono. Hyogemono is a name for a tea master, Furuta Oribe, I believe his name was. In any case, though, he's called Hyogemono in the manga, and he was known not only for liking tea, but also for liking tea cups and tea bowls that were very warped and individual. So now he is this character who's known for his individuality and for standing out from the crowd. So tea has gone from something that is part of the crowd to something now that you drink if you want to be an individual. If you want to be different from the crowd, you drink green tea. And that's in the modern period.
This is all very fascinating. And thank you so much again for your time and joining us on the channel today.
You're quite welcome. I enjoyed it very much. I hope that I got some people to drink some tea. And I hope that I also enlightened people a bit about the book and that they will enjoy it if they pick it up.
Yes, I'm sure next time we drink tea, we'll all have much to think about. So for our listeners, thank you for tuning in. This is New Books in Japanese Studies with Professor William Ferris and his new book, A Bowl for a Coin, A Commodity History of Japanese Tea. I am Jin Yi Lee, and I will see you soon.